Show me the law. I'm going to show you the law. I found it. They've been hunting all over for it, and I found it, and so we're going to get into that. However, this seminar is divided into three parts. The first part is the foundation. You will not be able to understand. You'll be looking right at the law and not know you're looking at it if you don't have the foundation. You've got to have this foundation first. So we're going to spend the first 7 hours on the foundation. It'll only take about an hour to discuss the law itself. And then it will take another couple of hours to show the remedy on the law. And the law and the remedy on the law, I think, will be quite apparent if you have a good foundation. So pay attention to that foundation. That is really, really important. Took me many years to focus in on it. Took a lot of bad decisions. You know, we got a lot of experience here. Where did that experience come from? It came from bad decisions. Okay? Experience comes from bad decisions. So we've made our bad decisions along the way. We got the experience. Now we can make good decisions based on that experience. So this is the foundation. What you see here, by the way, is on the website, 1215.org. Okay? This is the Nitty Gritty Law Library and Sovereign's Paradise putting on the show here. And this foundation, if you get this foundation down pat, you pretty well got it knocked. You can pretty well handle any situation that comes along. However, handling any situation coming along does not mean you have a license to harm other people. This is all premised on you being legally right, lawfully right, and morally right. If you don't have all three of those factors down, then you've got a problem. And if you are, it's possible to be legally wrong. You can be morally right and lawfully right, which means common law right, but you could be statutorily wrong. Well, the statutory wrong, that has to yield to the common law. Okay, so if there's a conflict between the common law and the statutory law, the statutory law must yield. Now you see, if you look at the codes say, particularly in California, I think it's the either the civil code or the code of civil procedure, I forget which, but I think it's 22.2, which says basically that that the common law shall be the rule of decision unless, or so long as it's not in conflict with the statutory law. And that is true if you're in the statutory house. If you set up your case to operate under statutory law, then that's how it's going to be. But in truth, the common law takes precedence if you start off in the common law house and use it. But we'll get into that. Anyway, the first thing I want to cover is attitude. This is really, really important. If you have a bad attitude, if you have an attitude where you're always angry, you're always upset, well, obviously, court procedures won't be fun. And let me tell you something. Court procedure can be lots of fun, especially if you're in charge. And but you have to have a good attitude. If you have an angry attitude, this will work against you for a number of reasons. For one thing, people start off simply not giving you the credibility. For some reason, anger reduces the credibility, the perception of credibility on the part of other people. So you basically have to be a very calm, very friendly kind of person, regardless of the issues that are going. So you, plus, if you are a person who is emotionally locked up and you're into anger, or if you're in any strong emotional position, be it happy or angry, You will be blinded to your opportunities. You will not see the opportunities that are there because of how your mindset will color your ability to perceive. So your mindset very much controls your ability to perceive. So the proper mindset, if you really want to do law well, is you've got to neutralize yourself and be open to everything. Don't be automatically rejecting things just because they conflict with whatever you're seeing or thinking or whatever. And by the way, this rule that I'm giving you applies to attorneys too. And the beautiful part is every attorney that I've ever had to deal with had a mindset that I was absolutely ignorant because I'd never been to law school and didn't know anything, and they took liberties and they weren't sensitive to the stuff I put into the papers, and then wham, they get it in the end, you know. And the very common thing that I hear when I go to court is the attorney says to the judge, he says, "Your Honor, I don't understand this paperwork." Well, the judge understands because he went through corrective schooling, commonly known as judges' seminars. You know, they have programs where they teach judges what the real law is, because somebody's got to keep the system straight, and they do. In fact, I've noticed a remarkable consistency in the codes, and I know the attorneys aren't that smart, and I wondered for a long time, how is it that they passed all these laws and had it right? Well, you look at the legislative procedure, and what they do is they pass it through to the legislative committee. And so one time I went up to the Capitol in Sacramento, and I thought, boy, this is an opportunity. And I went to the legislative committee's offices, and I happened to get a hold of a supervisor. And so I was all primed to ask the supervisor about the process they went through and how they reviewed it and so forth, you know. It took about 30 seconds for me to realize this person didn't have the first clue of what the real system was. So I had to change my program. And what I did was I asked the person, I said, "Well, could you explain the procedure, just exactly what happens when a proposed statute comes to your office? What is the next step?" And she says, "Oh, well, what we do is we have a meeting with the judges from the Supreme Court, and they critique it for us as well. And we work it out in a committee, in a meeting." So there you are. Here I thought that the fountain of knowledge would be in these legislative committees. Turned out they didn't have a clue. The real fountain of knowledge is with these high-level judges. They know. I've never had a problem with a high-level judge. I may have had problems, but they're all legitimate problems. They understand, they're well-educated, they're intelligent. These guys know. And if you get your act right, you'll get the results. So, again, its attitude is very important. When they perceive you as basically a good guy, that's what counts. There was very important lesson came to me out of that, and that is, make sure you're likable. I'm friendly to the judge. I'm friendly to the attorneys. You know, I have to admit, one of my moments of glory was when I had an attorney screaming at me so loud that you could hear the echoes off the end of the hall that was 300 feet away. But that was a rare opportunity. That doesn't happen every day. But even that guy liked me as a person. You know, he was just angry because he wasn't getting what he thought he should get out of the courts. But it's very important to have the right attitude. Get the clerks to like you. Those, you know, people don't have an axe to grind against you when you first walk in. But if you show an attitude that's bad, you can generate dislike, you can generate lack of cooperation. And I can tell you that some of the best research we've ever had done was done by the clerks themselves to help us. It's just amazing because they really like this. They perceive us as good people. I go in, I talk to the clerks all the time, and I do talk to them, you know, on a personal basis. And, "Hi, how are you? How's the family?" kind of thing. And you tell them a joke or something. So, it's a good way, because then they start cooperating with you. You don't look so much like a kook. Remember, you're doing some very, very strange things. I've had people ask me questions about doing certain procedures and so forth, and then I ask them, well, is that a good show? Does that convince the rest of the world that you're right? Well, it turns out it doesn't a lot of times. You know, just because you're legally right doesn't mean you're right in the public perception. And who is this public I'm talking about? Well, it's the court clerk, it's the sheriff, it's the marshal, it's the cops, it's the mayor of the city, if the case is important enough for him to notice it, and so on. It's all these people who hold the guns. Okay, you want those people to be convinced you're right. Now, they may know they're doing wrong and taking your rights away on purpose, but the first step is to have them know you're right. Now, when they know you're right and they're wrong, that takes a little bit of steam out of their efforts. Okay? There's something about us humans that, in general, we tend to limit ourselves. Just like I told you the story earlier about the Buddhist monk that was head of all the other monks. Nobody would kill him because they liked him. Okay? He knew how to run his court, so to speak. He knew how to keep things looking good so that as he did his damage, people held back. They didn't take retribution on him, even though he was a major problem internationally for the government. So that's the first consideration. A court is a stage upon which the sovereign conducts his show so as to satisfy the rest of the world that his decision is a good one. Now, sometimes you do find somebody not guilty, but basically, you're the plaintiff, the sovereign plaintiff. You know what the person did to you. He knows what you did to you. I mean, between you, you know what the truth is. So why have the court? You know, well, it's because you're actually putting on a show for the rest of the world. So put on a good show, okay? Don't take shortcuts. It'll pay. So that's what a court really is. In practical terms. Now, there's all kinds of courts. Okay, you know about admiralty courts, maritime courts, court of the exchequer, court of claims, all kinds of courts. But in America, there is only one court, and that's a court of record. All the other courts are what we call nisi prius courts. They are courts that exist because you failed to object. Okay?
And you call it what kind of court?
A nisi prius court. So that translates from Latin into without prior objection. A nisi prius court is a court that exists because of no prior objection. Okay? So, and you'll see it's right here. You see it, I have it on the menu, Nisi Prius Court. And one time, I got a letter from somebody objecting. And so I put his objection up on the website, and then I put my answer to it, describing a Nisi Prius Court. It might be worth studying. But the important thing to understand about a Nisi Prius Court is it's a court that exists without objection. So, all those courts I mentioned are nisi prius courts. Another way, you could call them contract courts, but they're contracted because of your failure to object. See, you don't have to have an overt act to have a contract, an overt agreement. By the actions of the parties, you know there's a contract going on. You know, if I give you some money, and then I walk off and take your car. We never had an agreement to do that, but you accepted the money and I accepted the car. You gave me the keys. Even if we never spoke a word, you know that there's some meeting of the minds there. Some agreement, right? After all, you took the money and I took the car. So a contract can exist on nothing more than the action of the parties. You don't have to have it in writing. You don't have to have the words spoken or anything else. Just what you did that shows there's a contract, an agreement, understanding. Nobody objected, right? You didn't object to me taking your car, and I didn't object to you accepting my money. So there's an implied contract there.
Well, the reason, Mr. Bill, we go back and forth like ping pong on my case is that I knew right away they need new contract. But since I refused to get into their plate, then that's what started the bouncing ball back and forth, you know, until the end of the day, you know, until the end of the year. So that really explained a whole lot. If you're in contract, then you could play in contract. If not, you understand what the court you're in.
Sure.
But I don't want to play the game. That's what it is.
Right. You don't have to agree to a contract, and don't act like you do. Or if you do act like you're going to go into a contract, make an objection when you go in. Now, what used to be known as a Uniform Commercial Code Section 1-207, or I guess in California it's 1207. Contract, you can do anything you want. It doesn't matter if it's gold or silver involved. It's whatever the parties agree to. Because in your sovereign capacity, you have unlimited power to contract.
Bill, I had this issue with the city of Carlsbad. They wanted me to fill out a business license form. I said, I don't need to. I said, I don't need your permission to contract.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and
that's
I said,
common law right.
Yeah, and I said, show me where you can force me to do this. And the lady said, well, I'll get back to you. I gave her my number, never heard from her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. A lot of times, one of the characteristics of a true monarchy or a true dictatorship is that things are done at the whim of the dictator. It's policy instead of law. So they have their policies of what they do, but obviously, so far anyway, there's no law.
Reading you, Bill, I got a question for you.
Get close to the mic.
Okay, I've got a question for you. I've got a building permit mm-hmm. that's still active, and I was wondering, if I have that building permit and it's still active, if a judge can appoint a receiver, does he have the jurisdiction to appoint a receiver when I've got a contract with the city?
Well, that answer is very simply answered by reading the contract.
Okay. Yes, that's what I thought. Yeah. I didn't think he had jurisdiction.
No, what acting party does not make a claim of an injury or threat of injury because of your failure to do or your threat to do something, then the judge has no authority either. But that's all in their court anyway. What you really need to do is a counterclaim on these guys and sue them.
Great. Okay, thank you very much.
We'll get into that later about the counterclaims. So anyway, so the Nisi Prius court is a court that exists because of the failure to object to whatever it is they are doing. And that's fine. You know, you can run a court any way you want as long as everybody agrees and as long as nobody objects. But if somebody objects, the only court that can exist without the voluntary participation of everybody is a court of record. Now, a court of record has to meet some criteria. Here's the requirements of a court of record. The first requirement is optional. It generally has a seal. The reason it's optional is because very simple. Back in olden days, the making of a seal was a very, very expensive proposition. They didn't have the tools, metalworking tools that we got today. And there were sovereigns who were too poor to have their own private metallurgist. So the seal is optional. And in fact, if you want a seal, all you have to do is put the word seal by your signature, and now it's sealed.
Are you aware that Black's 5th and 6th took out that fourth, number 4?
Pardon?
Black's 5th and 6th.
Well, I'm working toward these things. So I went to the United States District Court in Las Vegas a couple years ago, and I wanted some sort of a certified document, which means they'd have to say, look strange to these people, even though we have hundreds of years of tradition behind us. It looks strange to them because they're simply not taught. The attorneys are simply not taught this stuff. They have no clue. And coming from you, well, you have no authority as far as they're concerned. You know, what do you know? But you know a lot if you follow these procedures. So I'm just emphasizing this attitude is a big, big factor, much bigger than we really anticipate. And we get a lot of behind-the-scenes help from people that we could never prove we were helped, but I've seen judges do 180-degree turnarounds mysteriously. Just there were tigers on the bench, and suddenly they became like kittens. They were very nice and cooperative and so forth. Part of that was because of the fact that we fenced them in with the real law, but a big part of it also was the fact that they liked us. In one case, we had, I remember this judge just absolutely raking the attorney over the coals. It was spontaneous, you know, we weren't expecting it. We didn't even have any motion that was even close to it. But this judge went into a tirade against the attorney and told the attorney, you know, that the attorney was the one that was responsible for the delays in this case, and the attorney wasn't doing her homework, and the attorney wasn't doing her research. And I mean, he just went on and on for about 5 minutes on this attorney. And this was an attorney who had 5 years of experience in the court system. But when we went into that courtroom, we always said, "Hi, Your Honor, and nice to see you," and so forth, you know, and then we got down to business, of course. But on a personal level, it was just fine. And I know that these people will stab you in the back first chance you get, they get, you know. But when they like you, it takes a big chunk of energy out of their sails there, yeah, wind out of their sails. So this is, attitude is not law directly, but boy, it sure can have some surprisingly good effects if you have a good attitude. Okay, well, enough of attitude. Now we have language and dictionaries. Now, language and dictionaries, basically in America, we all speak three languages. The low-level language is called slang. Okay, that's the language of the street. It changes from moment to moment, from block to block, okay? So, and slang has some very interesting features in it, you know. So the formal English is our second language, and in order for strangers to communicate, we have to be educated in formal English, or business English, if you want to call it that. And so that's an important language, too. But it is a separate language, even though it's also called English. It's a language that's separate from the slang version. And then there's the language of the court, sometimes called the King's English or legal English. And that's a very, very stable language. That, you know, a word means the same thing today that it meant 300 years ago. And precedence is very important. And the legal dictionary is far larger than Webster's unabridged dictionary. If you go to the law library, the legal dictionary is not called a dictionary. It's actually called Words and Phrases, okay? Or you'll see that it's the Restatement of the Law. That's another name for it. Or American Jurisprudence. These are all dictionaries, as far as we're concerned, dictionaries of the English language. And if I remember the word to, spelled T-O. I remember it took several pages of court cases where battles were fought over the meaning of the word to. It really surprised me when I first saw that. So be sure when you are using the language, be sure that you're speaking the right language and you know that language. When you, one exercise that you could do that I did is just sit down with the Constitution and one of these dictionaries, and every single word, just pretend you never saw the language before, and every single word, no matter how simple it is, you know, what it starts off, we, look it up. You'd be surprised what that word means when you're talking legal language. And so if you did that, that would give you a tremendous force, you know, intellectual force behind you to make you more effective in writing your papers. It also makes you more effective in undermining the opposition, because often these attorneys, you see, when the attorneys go to law school, sure, they're taught a few meanings and so forth, but they're not actually told that it's a separate language. They don't realize that. And they will go in there. A lot of times you'll hear attorneys on the floor of the court speaking business English. You know, you can just chop them up if you pretend that they were speaking legal English, you can really screw them up, okay? Because they don't know, they're not educated. Attorneys are remarkably ignorant. I don't mean to downgrade attorneys, because I'm not saying they're dumb. They're very intelligent. A lot of them are extremely intelligent, okay? But being intelligent isn't good enough. You also have to use the right words. If you don't speak the right language, you can get in trouble in the courtroom. I think a very common misuse of word is the word resident, okay? You know, you ask anybody on the street what the word resident means, and resident means, well, you know, you live there, you belong here, right? That's your normal meaning for the word resident in everyday English. But when you get into the courtroom, the word resident means you're a foreigner, and you're here for a specific purpose, and once you accomplish that purpose, you're going to go home. If you're a resident of California, that means you're from someplace outside California. And you've got some purpose, and they assume it's a commercial purpose. Why do they assume it's a commercial purpose? Very simple. The Constitution of the United States authorizes Congress to regulate interstate commerce. And so if you say you're a resident of California, that means you're from outside the state, you've crossed the border, you've got a commercial purpose, and therefore they're entitled to regulate you. And that's by authority of the people who gave them the Constitution. So, very important to understand that word resident. Now, if you don't want to be a resident under those terms, the proper word is domiciled. Okay? If you're domiciled, that means you belong here. You don't need any excuse. This is where you live. This is where you belong. But if you're a resident, I'll show you an example of a common use of the word resident that is proper, that does match up with the legal meaning. And that is where a doctor does his residency in the hospital, right? He went to school, he got his MD, but he's not allowed to practice medicine, not till he completes his residency. So he goes into the jurisdiction of the hospital, crosses the border, he now subjects himself to their instructions and command. He goes through all the hoops that they have him jump through, and then once he completes the program successfully, he leaves. He leaves the hospital and goes out into private practice, and he has completed his residency. So there's a really good example of what residence means. So anyway, make sure you get your language right when you write your papers, and please, please pay attention to your spell checker, okay, on your word processor. If you put in paperwork with misspellings, I mean, some of the stuff I see is pretty sad. And believe me, when you put in bad spelling, the opposition looks at it and they figure, one way or another, they're going to beat you. You're too ignorant. Okay? So you can't do that. If you have trouble spelling, for Pete's sake, go down to one of the secretarial services and hire a secretary to read your paperwork and correct the spelling and correct the language. You know, sometimes we use slang without realizing it. So a good executive secretary can do a lot to save your paperwork from being disrespected. Okay. All right, let's get into the meat of this. People or citizen, which one are you? Basically, the people own the country, and the country owns the citizens. That's the basic relationship. So which do you want to be? You want to be a people, or do you want to be a citizen? You cannot be both at the same time. However, if you're one of the people, you can choose when you want to be a citizen. You can be a citizen for some purposes and not a citizen for other purposes. Now, how do you know whether or not you're a people? Well, if you look at the preamble, well, let's back up. Let's go into the history. When the United States declared its independence from Great Britain, King George wasn't too happy about it, and he got a little bit vindictive about it, and so he retaliated by canceling the charters that were granted, giving the giving the colonies official recognition. He canceled those charters. So the result was is that, technically speaking, there was no sovereignty, no sovereign law. So everybody became self-governing. We governed ourselves. So everyone became sovereign. And so when we finally got together for this modern constitution, I know we went through a phase. The colonies put together the Articles of Confederation, but that was the business of the colonies, not the business of the people. So when that wasn't working out, the people themselves stepped back into the picture. I mean, this is all theory, but it's theory that we generally accept in legal circles. And so we the people stepped back into the picture, took command of the situation, and redefined the system. And so, and this is expressed in the preamble. If you look at the preamble, it says in the preamble, "We the people of the United States." Okay? So that we the people stepped in. Now, what we did, we had a purpose. We said in order to form we said where we're from. We're people, we're from the United States, and our purpose was to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. And what are we doing? We ordain and establish this Constitution for whom? For the United States of America. So we the people were from the United States, which is two words, and we ordain and establish this Constitution for those guys over there called, four words, United States of America. So, you see, we were basically the creators of the United States of America. And the word ordain means to authorize, to make law. So this is the law of the people speaking. And we, by ordaining, we created this whole thing in the legal sense. And then we established this Constitution. And the word establish in this sense means we actually put it on paper. We wrote it. Okay? So we the people authorized it, and we the people established it, wrote it, so that there wouldn't be any confusion, I presume. So I want you to notice those words, ordain and establish. The people were sovereign, self-governing to begin with, and there is nothing in the word ordain and establish that says that we gave up anything. We were sovereign before we created it, and we're sovereign after we created it. So we the people gave up nothing. Well, that was a tough thing for the politicians to swallow. Okay? And over time, that was not really compatible with what they like to do. And because governments like to grow and grow, and unfortunately they don't know when to stop, so they grow to the point where they consume their own people. But this Constitution was written in such a way there was no authority on the part of the government to do anything with the people. The government was a separate entity with its general functions, but there was nothing in the Constitution that authorized the government to take control of the people. So they had to do something about that. It took a long time for them to figure out what to do, but eventually they figured it out. They came up with this device called the 14th Amendment. Now, if you look at the 14th Amendment, all persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside. You see, you're not a citizen of the United States unless you meet two basic conditions. The first condition is you have to be born here or naturalized, one of those two, but that's the first condition. The second mandatory condition is that you have to be subject to the jurisdiction. Well, if you're born here but not subject to the jurisdiction, then you're not a citizen of the United States. What are you then? Well, you're one of the people. The people are born here, but they're not subject. It's quite the opposite. The government is subject to the people. Okay? We, the people, ordained and created or ordained and established this Constitution for those guys over there. Those, by the way, they're not really the government. The true government is the people themselves. We are self-governing. The proper terminology, although we call the United States of America organization a government, it's actually a government agency. Okay? You notice they're all called agencies? That's because they're our agents. They're the agents of the people. They're carrying out tasks that we have mandated that they do for us if they want to get a paycheck from us. Okay? So, when you're a citizen of the United States, you become property of the United States. You have no rights, by the way, as a citizen. All you have is privileges granted by the government. But anyway, that's the background on that. Okay? So, if you're going to be one of the people, you have to know the difference between that and being one of the citizens. Now, you can be a citizen for some purposes and not a citizen for other purposes. After all, if you're in your sovereign capacity, you have the power, the legal power, to decide when you will or will not go into a contract with another party. And the federal government and the state governments are nothing more than other parties, okay? So, and this is how they get you. You know, you sign the 1040, there's your contract, okay? There's a number of things you contract, but these contracts do not grant general jurisdiction over you. They only grant jurisdiction over you for the purpose of that particular contract. If you have a driver's license, that does not mean you have to pay taxes. It does not mean you have to do a number of things. It only means that you have to have the driver's license according to your contract with them when you're doing the activities covered by that license. By the way, does anybody have a driver's license here? Okay. Pull it out and look at the back of it and see what it says. You might be surprised. It's in tiny print. And a lot of people cannot read small print. Okay? What does it say? Somebody read it out loud. This license is only valid for driving a motor vehicle. You ever wondered what a motor vehicle? Now we're going to talk legal language here. You know what a motor vehicle is? A motor vehicle is a self-propelled contrivance used in commerce. What does used in commerce mean? It means carrying passengers or cargo for hire. Right. If you look under, first of all, if you look at under California Code, section, I think it's 15210, that's the one that says that the California definitions shall apply unless there's a federal definition. Okay? So California is not being subjected to federal jurisdiction. It's the other way around. California is volunteering into federal jurisdiction. So that's not an issue about whether or not there's federal jurisdiction. It says specifically in the code that, yes, they are obligated, you're not, but they are obligated to obey the statutes. And you don't need that dictionary because we have it specified in the statute exactly what a motor vehicle is. And it's got to be a self-propelled contrivance used to carry passengers or cargo for hire. And if it's not doing that, it's not a motor vehicle. It's that simple. You don't need the dictionary. If you look at the definition in section 15210, the state has volunteered into federal jurisdiction as far as definitions go. And by the way, all the states that receive federal highway funding, they have to meet federal standards. And so one of the federal standards is Title 18, Section 31, which has definitions. And in there you will find motor vehicle, two words, specifically defined as a self-propelled contrivance that's used in commerce. And then if you look further down in Section 31, you will find where the phrase used in commerce is specifically defined as carrying passengers or cargo for hire, or something close to that anyway. So if you're not engaged in some form of, if you're not driving a motor vehicle, then you don't have a license to do what you're doing if you're just traveling. And then you don't need one. Where's the jurisdiction? So the cop out there on the street, he doesn't know he doesn't have jurisdiction, but he doesn't. Not if you're not engaged in commerce. Now, every trucker out there who has a driver's license who is carrying passengers or cargo for hire, yeah, he's subject to the rules, okay? And that's constitutionally authorized by the people. So just have a clear understanding whether or not you're using this vehicle in commerce. It's not good enough to be a vehicle. It has to be a motor vehicle to be in the jurisdiction. Okay, so... Yes, sir.
When you get a driver's license, then you're asking for a license to do that. Are you now not alleging that you are?
No, the license is only for the license is only for that activity. Okay, there's nothing in the licensing process that says that now you have to have it for travel. It's all commerce. I don't know if you've noticed it, but the motor vehicle department is under the tax collection department, and I got some very, very good advice one time from this fella. His name was Abraham Lincoln. Okay? I know a lot of people have some opinions about him, but he was an attorney. Okay? And he brought out a very important point, which is, if you don't want to argue a point, don't bring it up. Okay? Don't put in your papers that I reject the birth certificate. Just don't even mention it, even if you have one, okay? If they bring it up, well, sure, you attack them on it, but hey, you know, there's just too much. If you tried to cover everything, your papers will become like encyclopedias, whether you're one of the people or one of the citizens. So if you're one of the people, you own the government. If you're one of the citizens, you are subject to the government. You're subject to the whim of the government. So you don't have any rights when you're a citizen. Why? Because you're subject. You know? You must conform to whatever the rules are that they've laid out for you citizens. So a citizen does not have a right to own a gun. Okay? I know that's a big issue with a lot of people, but a citizen simply does not have a right to own a gun. He has a privilege to own a gun. It's a legislated thing, okay? And there may be legislation somewhere that says if we haven't legislated it, it's okay for him to do it, okay? But basically, citizens live by privilege granted by the government. And by the way, they don't like to call them privileges. That might wake the citizens up and get them to thinking about being people. But so they give these privileges a special name. They're called civil rights. Okay? Civil rights are actually civil privileges granted by the government. What if you want real rights, they're called natural rights that you're born with when you are one of the people. Yes, sir. Citizens, if you look at the 14th Amendment, it very clearly, very simple words, it says to be a citizen, you have to be born or naturalized and subject. If you're not subject, then you're not a citizen.
Hang on, but okay, I just understood you. In other words, there's no law that requires the people to file, but there is a law that requires a citizen to file because it's a privilege.
Right. You'll see that when the statutes are written, they refer to persons, not to people. The word people is not the plural of person. The plural of person, singular person, is persons with an S. Anybody remember the O.J. Simpson trial? Mm-hmm. You remember the Fourth Amendment issue, the exigency that was being considered in the municipal court before they transferred it to the Superior Court? That judge, she was... I don't think she was smart enough to write that opinion. I think somebody helped her on it. But when she read the decision, which essentially a lot of people said suspended the Fourth Amendment, when she read that decision, she was absolutely on target. She never used the word people anywhere in that decision. She referred to person or persons all the way through, from beginning to end. She had her language right, and when you understand that citizens live by privilege, not by right, she was right on target with that decision. There were a lot of attorneys criticizing her, and those attorneys were wrong. Now, if O.J. Simpson's attorneys had the understanding to take the position that he was one of the people, that might have had a different outcome.
I got a question.
Yes, sir.
In terms of the 14th Amendment, so would it be correct to say that as a person who was domiciled in California, born and raised in California, that I am one of the people of California and a non-resident foreign to the United States government?
Yeah, you do not have to accept U.S. citizenship. You know, you can just be a resident. Remember, the true country is California, and the United States of America is merely a corporate trust. I mean, if you look at the preamble, it has every element that you would expect to find in a trust. It has the trustor, the trustee, the beneficiary. It has the purpose. Everything's in that little short paragraph, all the elements. And so and you can tell that the United States of America is actually a corporation. Mm-hmm. The way you can tell is very simple. It has a president. All corporations have presidents. Countries have governors. Because they have a governor because he's acting in behalf of their boss, which is the people.
Hey,
you're welcome. So anyway, what we're going to talk about here is the Bill of Rights. Now, if you're one of the people, you've got all rights. Okay? I mean, when you delegated authority to the United States of America or to the states, you delegated that authority, you gave up nothing. You're still sovereign, okay? So we'll get into sovereignty in a little bit, what sovereignty is all about. But I want you to know that if you're one of the people, you have all rights. Whereas if you are a citizen, you only have certain rights. No, I'm an American. And I'm talking about citizens and people. And this is part of the entertainment. You don't want a boring session on law, do you? Come on, we got to have a little sense of humor here.
Well, you know, sometimes I worry as a little girl, I don't understand. I have to ask.
No, it's attitude. You know, you got this whole legal process should be fun. Okay, if you're steeped in anger and all serious, I'm sorry, but you're shortchanging yourself. Yeah, you got to talk right into it.
Okay, the 14th Amendment has not been ratified, so how can we have the 14th Amendment?
Okay, the 14th Amendment has not been ratified. I don't think I have the microphone on here. I think we need the microphone. How's that?
And also the 16th.
Okay, the issue that has been brought up is that the 14th Amendment has never been ratified. Let me tell you something, that's not important, okay? We're dealing with, let's put it this way. When you go to China, if you were in a Chinese court, do you think you would argue your case in English? Or would you argue your case in Chinese?
Chinese.
Yeah, you want these people to understand you. Now look, I go into a courtroom, and I know the attorneys, the clerks, the public that's out there watching what's going on, they all believe that the 14th Amendment is valid. And maybe even the judge, he may believe that it's valid, okay? He may be poorly educated as a judge. So I play the game. And I'm going to play the rules as much as possible according to their understanding. so long as it doesn't give up my rights. Now, if it gives up my rights, I'm going to educate them, all right? But as long as their rules help me, I'm going to use their rules. I'll apply them. And so they think the 14th Amendment is valid, so do I. Okay? And I'll use their own words against them. So the 14th Amendment says that you have to be born or naturalized and subject. Well, I'm not subject. That's what they believe in, and they believe in that word subject. And I'm telling them, I'm not subject. I'm over here, over on the preamble. Okay? So, again, if you don't want to argue a point, don't bring it up. You can develop a whole case on whether or not the 14th Amendment is valid. For what? You know? It doesn't apply to me anyway. I'll let them have it valid. Sure, it's fine. It's valid. Okay? It doesn't apply to me because I'm over there as a people. And I choose not to volunteer into citizenship. Not for that purpose. You can be a citizen for some purposes and not a citizen for other purposes. Okay. You're subject to the jurisdiction. So I guess that's an adverb. Well, if you subject yourself to the jurisdiction, then you're granting them the authority. Okay. You're the source. The requirements for citizenship are that you have to be born or naturalized and subject to the jurisdiction. If you're not subject to the jurisdiction, then you're not a citizen. And so, and it's your choice. This is a free will choice that you can make. And of course, they schnooker you into making the choice they want you to make by simply regulating the education that they give you when you're in the public schools. Okay? They don't teach you the words of freedom. They teach you the words that subject you, that put you into their jurisdiction. So they don't teach you, all you ever hear when you're in the school area is you hear about being a good citizen. You hear about being a resident. You hear the word resident used all over the place. How often do you hear the word domiciled? Okay? But the word domicile is the one that gives you the freedom. All right? Then you have another interesting thing is that you'll notice that in all the public schools, you have to register. Your children are registered into the school. Instead of, they used to say enrolled. Now they say registered. What's the difference? Well, registration, excuse me, registration is when you register something that came from the outside the jurisdiction. Enrollment, you already belong in the jurisdiction. We're just putting you on the list. But registration is when you're outside. You ever heard of a ship's registry? Well, the ship is registered outside the jurisdiction. Okay? Ships go into other jurisdictions, so they have to register. So when you enroll, you're from here, the jurisdiction that you're enrolling in. That's why they say registration in school now instead of enrollment. And of course, the people are not well educated, so they sometimes mix these words. I didn't say that. I said it the other way around. If you are subject to the jurisdiction, and if you are born here, then you are a citizen. Was he part of the prosecution? Okay, your prosecutor asked her, you wanted to know if she was a citizen. You'll notice that on the criminal papers, the charges or whatever it is that they generate in the district attorney's office, you'll see that they'll put your social security number and your driver's license number on there. Okay? Why? Well, that's proof you're a citizen. Okay? Prima facie proof, by the way, which means that you can upset that assumption. They'll make the assumption until you counter it. Okay?
So how do you counter?
With your counterclaim. Okay, we'll get to that. That's part three. Okay, so I just want you to be aware of the difference between people's rights and citizens' rights. Now, I went to a book. This book is published by the Senate of the United States. The Senate gives a free copy of this book to every senator, every congressman, and to the vice president. Why doesn't the president get one? Yeah, the president's in the executive branch. The vice president is part of the Senate. He's the president of the Senate. And so he gets a copy. Now, this book is called The Constitution of the United States of America, Analysis and Interpretation. Okay? And that's a very interesting book. It's got some 3,000 pages almost. And if you go to the book, which is called Senate Document 99-16, on page 956 and 957, footnote 12, you will see a list of the privileges that are available to citizens. Okay? So, for example, the First Amendment of the Bill of Rights is available, religion, speech, press, assembly, and petition. The Second Amendment is not available to U.S. citizens. Quartering of troops, there's no cases, but they decided to throw it over on that side anyway. Okay. Grand jury indictment, you're not entitled to a grand jury indictment. You're not entitled to a jury trial in civil cases if you are a citizen of the United States. And you're not entitled to bail, necessarily. And you're not entitled to protection against excessive fines or equal protection. Okay? All of those are not available to the U.S. citizens. That's the 2nd, 3rd, 5th, 7th, and 8th Amendments, the Bill of Rights. On the other hand, they have legislated that you are entitled to the First Amendment, 4th Amendment protections, 5th Amendment double jeopardy, self-incrimination, and just compensation, and the 6th Amendment protection has been so much diluted, but the 6th Amendment, you are still legislatively entitled to speedy trial, public trial, jury trial, impartial jury, notice of charges, compulsory process to get witnesses in, and a right to counsel. And you are entitled to protection against cruel and unusual punishment. So that's the list right there. It's right in the Senate book. Okay? I love that book. It tells the truth. Now, it isn't that they don't want it. It isn't that they don't want to lie. Yes. Well, every once in a while, they publish this book. Okay? I think the first one was published back around 1910 or something like that. And it comes out every so often. There's been as few as I think 3 years between publishings, and there's been as many as 25 years between publishings. But every once in a while, they come out with a revised edition. And it basically brings in new court cases and that have affected and so forth. It's a very good book, actually. But if you lay down, and I've done this, I've taken a very old copy with a very new copy, and I put them side by side, and you can see that the language that they use, they don't change the concepts. But what they do change is the wording to describe the concepts, and the newer books make it easier to misinterpret. The older books were clearer, were more clear, okay? And, yeah, obfuscation. And you'll also notice that in the old books, if you look in the index, there's almost a full page of references to the common law. And in the newer books, there's zero reference to the common law. It's still in there, by the way, the common law. If you know where to find it, it's still there. Now, the beauty of it is this, is that this book I've got on the website, okay, and you can search it, okay? There is a search engine on the website, so you can look up stuff, and it will lead you to that book, okay? So that's kind of neat.
Bill, how often is that book updated?
Well, like I said, I just said 3 years one time, another time was 25 years went by. You know, it depends on what the urgency is. Now, let's get into sovereignty, okay? It's very important to be sovereign, okay? If you're not sovereign and you decide to be a citizen, this is how you might end up. Okay? So, I don't think you want to be like this. So, I suggest you be sovereign. It's a lot more fun, a lot more Okay? But anyway, we're going to talk about sovereignty. And so we were self-governing 100%. And then the colonies got together and decided to form an organization themselves. And so that was the Confederation. You had the Articles of a Confederation to set the rules. Well, that didn't really work out as well as I guess some people wanted. So we had our Constitutional Convention and revised it considerably and came up with the Constitution. So in the Constitution, if you read the last part of the Constitution, you'll find that the people had decided to have to use this Constitution, but it would only be put into effect if nine of the colonies would agree. I guess they were states by then. And so when they got the nine to agree, then it was a go. If they couldn't get it, it would have been a no-go. So the states were contracted into this whole thing, okay? The people ordained it, but the states contracted into it, okay? This is why the states cannot back out. It's because they have a contract that was not allowed to be broken. Okay? Now, there's some strong argument about the states wanting to, the southern states wanted to break out because the northern states were not playing according to the rules. And the southern states wanted to hold closer to the Constitution, and the northern states, who were primarily manufacturing, were more into the admiralty style of operating. So that created quite a difference of opinion. I've seen the actual letter order that was signed by President Lincoln authorizing the invasion of the declaration basically of war on the southern states. And the actual reason was failure to pay the taxes.
By the Southerners.
The southern states, you see, the federal government got its funding from the states. And so they failed to pay their taxes, so therefore it had to be enforced. That was the legal reason. The public reason, of course, was slavery. They had to get round up the support of people, but the legal reason was that. So anyway, what do we got here? Okay, so interesting thing about sovereignty is I've pointed out to you by looking at the Constitution, looking at the preamble, you can see the relationship. We ordain and establish it. So right there, that shows our relationship. And there's nothing that in there that says we gave it up. But California gets very specific. In California, if you look at section 11120 of the government code, and that's the Bagley-Keene Act, or if you look at section 54950 of the California government code, which is known as the Ralph M. Brown Act, both of them have identical wording. And if you look here in the Bagley-Keene Act, it says right there in the third paragraph, the people of this state do not yield their sovereignty to the agencies which serve them. That's a pretty clear statement to me. You look at the California Government Code, the Ralph M. Brown Act, and it says in the second paragraph, the people of this state do not yield their sovereignty to the agencies which serve them. Now, there is one interesting difference between the two statements, and that is that in the first one, state is lowercase, and the second one, state is capitalized.
Why is that?
Don't know, but it doesn't matter. I do not yield my sovereignty. Whatever interpretation they make does not apply to me. That's the beauty of this whole concept, is that a lot of these things that might be important when you're inside their system suddenly become meaningless when they're outside the system. Okay? So we're above the Constitution. We created the Constitution. The Constitution says right in the Constitution of the United States that we ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. It wasn't for the people. It was for the United States of America. Okay? So that's why it doesn't apply to you or me. It applies to them. And it's more than